This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. You find us here on Saturdays, at least we hope you have by now, and we talk about the disease of addiction. Most specifically, we talk about the many, many roads to recovery. It's all sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. We will have more about them straight ahead. I know it's a busy weekend. I know a lot of people are running around right now, getting the last deli trays left in the Delaware Valley, making sure everything's set for tomorrow. So as you do that, spend some time with us, because the purpose of the program is to inform people about the disease of addiction. I know you read about it. It's much in the news. We are in the midst of an epidemic that's literally killing thousands of people. So it's a very important topic, substance abuse and what can be done about it. Recovery Radio. So stay with us on this Saturday. We welcome back to the program a frequent contributor to the program, Amanda Kimball. She's been with us many, many times. Amanda is in the outpatient services division part of Retreat, and she is a clinical supervisor there. Hello, Amanda. Good to see you again.
Hi, Steve. You too.
Is everybody excited because it's the big weekend?
They are. I'm not. I'm a Steelers fan, but most of my staff
are
Eagles
fans. That is no way to start this. I'm laughing because so is my son-in-law.
Nice.
And we're in the midst of fighting over the children right now. But anyway, welcome back to the program. Now I'm going to need to talk to our guest even more on a personal basis. So I know you brought someone with us, and I'm really looking forward to this. As I was saying to Mark just before we went on the air here, you know, we talk about people on this program who are either, you know, in active substance abuse or here at Retreat or other places being treated for that. So we sort of have a really narrow view of them. They are either abusing drugs or trying to stop abusing drugs. Today we're going to find out, well, okay, who are they? Mm-hmm. What went into this beyond just the active use of the substances? Who are they? How did they develop their personality? And what can be done once those questions are answered to maybe help them? To that end, you brought someone with this. Who is this?
I did. This is Mark Olasky. He is our licensed clinical psychologist in our outpatient department. He's going to talk a lot about this today.
Mark, thanks for joining us on Recovery Radio.
Good morning.
You know, most people who know me go, you talk to a psychologist. You know, Steve, that's a very good idea. For you, I have a lot of questions because ever since I used to fall asleep in school during the psych class, I realized I've missed something. So I really want to find out a lot about it. So tell us about your background as a psychologist.
Well, I've been a licensed psychologist since 1993. I did my undergraduate work at Shippensburg State from 1978 to 1982. Worked a few years in the group homes in Chester County when they were closing the state hospitals and moving people into the community. And went to Trinity University in San Antonio for my graduate work. And from there, I've been pretty much all over the place as far as clinical work in mental health as well as now substance abuse.
Is substance abuse a new area for your
work? I think over the last 30 years, I would say it's relatively new. I think I've been in substance abuse about 9 or 10 years now.
Okay. So did I get that right? Is part of what you do as a clinician try to figure out not so much, you know, what happened in people's past, but who they are and how their personality was shaped in an effort to help them with their substance abuse problems? Is that what the goal of the psychologist is?
I think that's part of it. I think one of the things we do, and I've been influenced by a number of people throughout my career, and one of the things stances I take is really trying to get to know the whole person, to get a whole history, a whole background of where they are, what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. And I do look at their personality development and where they've been throughout their life. As we know, people tend to develop longitudinally as far as their personality goes. And what we look at is we look at anything that happened at any particular time in their lives that may have thrown that process off. And I think that's key to not only the addiction piece of things, but also to the relapse process as well.
Yeah. Currently, when we look about, for instance, the opioid epidemic, most of us go, gee, look, it can happen to anybody. And they see the sort of external features. Oh, a nice neighborhood, parents. That really can obscure some important stuff that's going on in the background, correct?
It can, but I think, you know, generally speaking, the substance abuse population doesn't have any more of significant issues, mental health issues, mm-hmm. or other issues, so like traumas or whatever, than the non-substance abuse population. I think you could look at a whole bunch of different things and see what's going on. One is just our society in general, as far as we are a let's get high society. I mean, alcohol, drugs, they're just a part of our culture. It's almost a rite of passage these days.
And yet that's what makes – and Amanda, you can jump in here as well. That's what makes what you guys do in regard to this so fascinating, because – yes, it's absolutely true, and there's been lots written now that not only is it a very common thing for people to want to, inebriate themselves. People want to go from being, you know, sort of here to over there, and they'll use it either cigarettes sometimes or a drink or mm-hmm. a beer mm-hmm. to the very unfortunate end. But you guys deal with people who can't do that.
Right.
They can't do that, and that's where all the clinicians come in, but certainly a guy like Mark would come in. At what point do you start seeing somebody in their treatment? Is it immediate, or how?
Well, generally speaking, our folks do they complete our inpatient program, and then they meet our criteria for stepping down to the partial hospital program, which is a more intensive outpatient program, and pretty much a segue from the safety net of the inpatient program to getting more in touch with real life. Now I've got to start facing some things that I've been able to put on the shelf while I was inpatient, and transitioning over to that venue.
Amanda, how important is it for someone in treatment to be self-aware, to answer some of these questions?
I think it's essential. I mean, there's going to be no change that's brought about if people are not aware of the damage they've caused, of their own issues. So I think that really part of what we need to do in the outpatient setting is allow or facilitate, our patients looking at themselves, what's gone on, and how they can fix it.
Yeah. Mark, When you how does it work with you? Is this the standard movie thing where somebody comes in, lays down on a couch, and you sit around taking notes?
I had a couch in the old building. They took the couch away from me, so I don't have a couch.
We did take the couch away.
But basically what I do is we use a group format primarily, and I do a couple of groups a day back to back, and I think one of the things that's so powerful in group is people can hear each other, and they don't just have to listen to the psychologist or somebody who's kind of in the periphery. They get a lot of support from one another. They also get kind of what we call an installation of hope. People have had some time under their belt. They find out what's worked for other people, and they find out what hasn't, and they grow very close to each other, and that's curative in its own right.
In a psychological context, where you're probing here, do people in that group setting, can they learn as much from hearing other people and their experience as opposed to you saying to them, well, what happened here and what happened there?
It's actually a bit both, because I'll jump in. And I'll jump in, and sometimes I'm pretty active in my treatment, unlike the classic therapist on TV where you're just and listening. I have people for a very brief period of time,
right.
Even if I have them for a month. That's a very, very, very brief period of time. And I try to help them bring associations to what they're doing and why they're using, and I help them make the connections. I literally give the answers sometimes.
Yeah, you've got to engage them in a very quick and deep basis, I'm sure. Mark Oleski is our guest, along with Amanda Kimball, both from Retreat. We're talking about the psychological underpinning, I guess, anyways, the foundation for who the people are, who they deal with in their practice as helping substance abusers. Mark is a licensed clinical psychologist, the first one we've had on the programs. And every time I walk past your office, I go, what is it with that guy? You can't be that busy. I know you are, though. So So let me ask you about this, the give and take. We know that denial is a problem with this disease, but I suppose at some point when they're sitting in front of you or one of Amanda's clinicians, that a little bit of that denial goes away. But what do you do when you're confronted with someone that you know is not telling the truth or is avoiding looking at the facts? What do you do as a psychologist in that context?
I'm pretty straightforward. Okay, and what I use is I really use the power of the group. Because that individual that you're talking about is much more open to colleagues than a therapist. A therapist takes on a lot of different meanings for a lot of different people. There's the transference that we talk about in old-time Freudian terms. And they may see someone like myself as an authority figure, or, you know, you're the therapist, you don't have no idea what I've been through, et cetera, et cetera. So they might block me out. They might defend against that. And that may not help that denial. We can get into a tug of war. But they hear other colleagues of themselves or like themselves in the group. That's poignant. That really hits home.
Yeah, I'm reminded, Amanda, many, many times talking to clinicians about the group setting and how important that is. Too many people on the outside, I think, believe that the group is just a kind of security blanket, and it's way more than that. There's a lot of power in that room. I guess it's easier in a group setting for the group to go, come on, man, you're not being honest.
Absolutely. That's what happens. And our groups tend to be very, very active, very honest with one another, yet very supportive. And there are times where group members will basically enable or sugarcoat somebody else's issues. And then that's when I jump in and I'll make mention of, like, what's the group doing here? Come on, guys. That's not what we're about.
Because we're not just showing up here to sit around.
Exactly. Exactly.
And trade stories. Hi, welcome back to Recovery Radio. Our guest in the studio this week, Amanda Kimball. Amanda's a longtime contributor to the program. She stops by every now and then. She's always great. She's clinical supervisor at Retreat. And she has brought in one of her people here at the outpatient facility at Retreat, and that is Mark Oleski. Mark is a clinical psychologist here at Retreat. And again, as I said, the first time I think we've had a psychologist on the program. A little bit later, maybe we'll get into some of the dual diagnosis that we have talked about in the past. But we're taking a little deep dive in the mind of someone who's struggling with drugs or alcohol. Too often we just go, well, they got a problem, they should stop behaving that way. Mark's job is to go beneath that and expose to people or shed light on some of the factors that may be contributing to that behavior. Did I get that right?
That's good. Yeah.
You know, I tell people that I can certainly see how someone who's abusing alcohol might not recognize it as abusive behavior, even if their behavior is crazy, because alcohol is accepted. It's a social lubricant. It's legal. Everybody does it.
Sure.
Now with this opioid situation, so it seems to me that the ability to ignore this behavior is probably not as easy if you are addicted to opioids. Is that true? I mean, is it hard? I guess what I'm saying is, are people who are hooked on heroin or any opioid, are they more honest about their condition, or is it pretty much the same deal?
I think it's pretty much the same deal across the board.
Is that right? Mm-hmm.
I really do. I think they'll tend to minimize it. They tend to justify it. They tend to rationalize it.
Yeah, but tell me, as a psychologist, how is it possible? Look, a guy's in a bar 3 days, 4 days, 5 days a week. Uh-huh. He's with everybody else. Everybody else goes home. Mm-hmm. He goes home. If you're in a bad part of the city at 2 o'clock in the morning, desperate to score heroin, how could you possibly minimize that? What goes on in their mind?
I think one of the things about the human condition is it's our gift and our curse, okay? Human beings adapt. They adjust. Okay, that's why we have people living in places they shouldn't be living, like the Sahara or the North Pole. Same thing with heroin addiction and whatnot. The disease is so strong that people get desensitized to the things you're talking about, like down in Kensington or wherever they are scoring. They get desensitized to that. The other thing is you have a whole different part of the brain that starts taking over, and that's the midbrain. That's that automatic part of the brain that we really don't have a heck of a lot of control over. And our rationalization, or not rationalization, but our good thinking, our impulse control, okay, our rational thought, which is the cortex, the outer layer, that goes away. People are in desperation mode. And that's one thing that most people in our society, at least here in the United States, have not experienced, is true desperation, where you will do whatever you need to do to get X, Y, or Z. And that's a whole different mindset.
And that's what baffles most people. And I think it's what contributed to the stigmatizing of this disease for so very, very long, where people said there's something, you know, this is a character flaw. No sane person would be behaving like this. Mm-hmm. So as a psychologist, what I hear you saying is that that behavior, which is destructive, devastating to families, ultimately leads to a lot of people dying, in an effort to keep getting high, mm-hmm. the thing that we use to modify our behavior, our minds, our rational mind, mm-hmm. is working against the addict.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so the thing that's going to save you is now the enemy.
Well, that part of the brain is, okay, because the cortex, the part that is our good rational thinking, the part that says, no, this is not a good idea, the part that says, I burned my hand on the stove burner, better not do that again, that's pretty much shut down.
So, but in your work as a psychologist, when you're discussing this with people, pointing out to them that this is what's going on, How do they react to you? It would seem to me they would just say, yeah, but I still have to get high.
Yeah, they know. There's a part of them that's still very, very, very aware of what they're doing. And they live with this internal conflict, mm-hmm. hence the guilt, the shame, and the negative self-image that results from the addiction. They know they're hurting family. They know they're living a life that is basically unthinkable. And they have such a conflict about this, and they feel such guilt, such shame. They feel like losers. They feel the character defects. There's something just inherently wrong with me, mm-hmm. that I can't get better. So they're very aware as well.
Yeah. Psychologically, I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but psychologically, are these people suicidal? Are they trying to hurt themselves or kill themselves?
I've had people, and it's not uncommon, where people get to such a level in their addiction where they are so discouraged about inability to get better that they'll actually overdose and kind of leave it up to God as to whether they wake up or not.
But it's kind of a fatalistic kind of thing. They're so out of highway, Amanda, that they don't care whether they come out of this or not.
Right. It's not intentional.
Right. Nobody writes a suicide. See, that's what
right.
Nobody writes a note saying, I'm going to take this shot and I'm going
mm-hmm.
to die.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why we see mm-hmm. these in newspapers. It's very confusing for people to say an accidental overdose. Well, they're all accidental,
mm-hmm.
right? So we're
mm-hmm.
not talking about psychologically people who are suicidal.
Well, suicidal is there's a continuum of suicidality. I would say, yes, they're suicidal. But are they to the level of I want to pull the gun out or hang myself?
Or jump off a
lethality.
Building. Or, right.
You have to look at the lethality.
Yeah.
They're really ambivalent, whether I wake up or not. But if it's okay if I don't, okay. But it's okay if I do, maybe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. We're going to take another break here now, but you know, when we come back, I would like to find out how much of that behavior, and we know the drug hijacks the mind and changes the chemistry and all that, but before they became that person who's abusing substances, what factors went into it? I mean, the cliche is, you know, mom didn't love me as much as she loved my brother and all of that stuff. I really want to get a little deeper into that. And also we'll use that section of the program to talk about why this is important with regard to relapse. Hi, welcome back to Recovery Radio. We'll get back to our guest, Mark Oleski and Amanda Kimball straight ahead. But first, I want to give you the phone number that they give you every week, and I give it to you with the same message. I hope you never need to use it. It's the phone number for Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. They are a world-class organization. Their reputation is impeccable. They've helped lots and lots of people. But Peter Shure, the founder, said, yeah, absolutely true, but give them the phone number, and if they have any questions about anything they've heard on the program or any questions about the treatment they're getting now, then just give them the number. We'll be glad to help. So it's in that spirit, 855-859-8808. This is one of those phone numbers like police and fire on your refrigerator that is there. God forbid you need it, but if you did, it could be important. So write this down, 855-859-8808, Retreat, premier addiction treatment centers. Amanda Kimball with us, clinical supervisor, and she's brought her colleague, Mark Oleski, clinical psychologist. So let's before we get into the relapse stuff and how this is beneficial, this psychological evaluation and treatment for people, how deep do you have to go? I mean, are you talking about childhood potty training and mom and dad and who loved who? Do you go that deeply?
I think you know there is a piece of the treatment to that. There we have people with have had traumas, issues like anybody else out there that aren't in addiction and don't have addiction issues, and there are people out there that have some really 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 big issues. And it can be trauma, it can be abuse of a variety of different kinds, and we also help work with that to try to help them cope with that. Remember, now, one of the things we look at is that the one thing we know about human beings is we do things that serve a purpose. Okay, the only things that people do is serve a purpose. Hence, you bring the drugs and alcohol into play when you're talking about traumas and whatnot. There may be a purpose that we're trying to identify where the drug and alcohol comes into play here. Is it a low self-esteem? Is it I've been abused? Is it that I've turned that abuse inward and I feel I'm a horrible person and I have a sense of guilt, shame, and that kind of stuff? Or am I trying to numb myself from some unconscious trauma that's trying to make its way through? Okay, so we look at those kinds of issues. We make some connections between those issues as well as the addiction. And then what we'll do, because we have our people for a relatively brief period of time, even a month is not a long enough time to get into those kind of issues and resolve those issues. And we'll refer out to trauma specialists mm-hmm. and whatnot, where they can go ahead and they can dig into that kind of stuff. And people who also have experience with addictions and addictions treatment, and they're ready and willing to work with our folks, and they'll address that in a longer term mm-hmm. process.
What we know from many times of talking to all kinds of clinicians in all specialties here at a place like Retreat, that the treatment for substance abuse is not one thing of a certain length. It's a process. It involves lots of techniques, and it's ongoing. Is your role as a psychologist, and you said you only have people sometimes for a very short period of time, mm-hmm. is to get them into a position where they can have that kind of psychological talk, but with themselves? Do you know what I mean? Where
that's definitely part of it. I think, you know, insight is absolutely essential. And the other factor with the insight is I have to take what I learn and turn it into behavior right. to make the change. Mm-hmm. And that can be daunting for a lot of people. And it also takes deliberate effort. And that's something that we're not used to generally in healthcare. Generally in healthcare, we go to the doctor, we get some antibiotic, we don't even take the full course of antibiotic, and my strep throat is gone.
Yeah, we're a passive participant in that yes. process. And what you're talking about involves an active behavior. How insightful are most people? Can they see their step back and observe their behavior even when it's negative? Are they able to do that at some point?
Yeah, you have different levels. Some people will rationalize and justify, and some people will defend against that, because we really don't like looking at ourselves in the mirror and really honestly looking and saying, wow, I have some deficiencies I really need to work on. And then you have people who are really capable of doing that. And it is a process, and that's the piece to the whole treatment, is that is a process, and being able to become self-aware, where I get to the point where I accept what I've done, who I am, I accept my issues without a sense of guilt and shame that I have to defend against. Now I can go ahead and fix it. Now I can do things about it.
Mark, as a psychologist, maybe you can answer this question for me. One of the things I have been I always say when we have someone on to talk about their treatment and recovery, I begin it by saying all stories of substance abuse and recovery are the same, except they're different. Mm-hmm. But one thing that is almost universal that I've heard over and over again now for years from people is that when they began experimenting and using substances, mm-hmm. they all talk about, and these are some young people, they all talk about an emptiness, a hole. I didn't fit. What is that?
I think, you know, in my experience, what I do is I take a developmental look at that. And I think just as human beings, we have a need to affiliate. We have a need to fit in. And when you're looking at when substance use generally gets going, it's generally in that period of the early middle teens where we're still trying to figure out who we are. We're still trying to fill that hole. Okay. We're looking to other people to do that. And instead of going through the process without the substances in a healthy manner where we are able to fill that hole with a sense of self-esteem, self-confidence, our own life experiences, we fill it with the drugs and the alcohol. Now you take the drugs and alcohol away and there's that emptiness. Mm-hmm. I'm actually delayed a bit developmentally is what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the family in the context of the psychology of someone who winds up abusing substances. Is there anything, for instance, parents can do and should be on the lookout for psychologically, developmental-wise, that might be a red flag or something they should look out for?
I think instead of a red flag, I think one of the things to do is really communicate with the kids. This is a danger. Okay, this is real. Okay, also know your personal family history because genetically this kind of thing is passed on. So people with the genetics oriented towards a genetic history of substance abuse, they're at higher risk. We've got to talk about that. We've got to make that real. Also, maybe and here's the hard part, maybe we have to change our lifestyle a little bit and not include alcohol in the family unit or make that part of what we consider fun or those kinds of things. I think one of the things we need to look at as far as the kids is they tend to be secretive, maybe isolate a bit more. Stay on top of our kids.
It's very hard to distinguish typical or normal, I should say, teenage angst with problem behavior mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. most kids are awkward and mm-hmm. don't know where they fit. It's this thing about talking to kids is more critical than ever. It's so easy now for a kid to get messed up on this stuff. Do you counsel families as a psychologist? In addition,
families are always invited in, you know. And there tends to be a range of availability, accessibility, as well as their own perception of what addiction is all about. People need to be educated. And that's really my role when I do see families is not necessarily a family therapy thing, but it is support. It is to kind of tie it up and educate people and let them know kind of what they should or shouldn't do. Yeah. Or help them out with that process.
Is it your experience that family members might look at a psychologist involved in this process and go, oh, great, he's in there telling them it's my fault that I did this. Do they worry?
They do. Yeah, they do. You know, it's always about the mom. It's always about the dad and all that kind of thing. And that's what the first thing that I put aside right from the get-go. I address that this isn't anybody's fault. This is there are a whole gamut of factors that are involved here, namely even just choices that the kids make at any given time. It's just their choice. We raise our kids to the best of our ability, and then they go out into the world where the world has much more influence over them than we do. I forget, somebody did a study one time and found out that the parents' actual influence over their kids was less than 5% compared to all other factors.
Right. And no parent wants to even think about that. Nope. You can do the best job you can, and then they walk out the door and it becomes a crapshoot.
Absolutely.
The idea that the world is random is terrifying. Let me ask you something, and then we'll get it into the next segment. We'll talk about relapse, but this is all leading towards that. As a psychologist, you talk to somebody long enough as a professional, you're going to see stuff that happened in their childhood that if it didn't cause the substance abuse, it certainly contributed mm-hmm. to it. And I don't even mean obvious things like abuse or stuff, just developmental mistakes that were made along the way or progressions that didn't happen. Are they fixable?
Absolutely. I think one of the things is that we know about those kinds of things, developmental things. We have what we call critical periods in our life, physiologically as well as emotionally and psychologically. And those are times where we are most open to those kinds of developmental milestones, whether it's walking, talking, a sense of self, whatever. However, what we do know is that you can always go back and fix and work on it. Now, it takes more effort because we're somewhere else in our lives chronologically doing other things, but we can always go back and fix that stuff. But it's a conscious effort.
First of all, you have to be aware that you didn't progress at the right pace or in the right moment.
Sure.
And maybe that's causing you pain now.
Absolutely.
But the important thing to remember is that, as somebody once said to me, it's never too late to have a happy childhood.
It's never over.
Yeah.
The game's never over. You can always go back.
Yeah, but this notion that, well, okay, that happened when I was 8 or 10 or whatever, 3, and it's messing me up now, is fixable. It's very important for people to understand that.
Absolutely.
Hi, welcome back to Recovery Radio. I want to thank, before we go any further, Amanda Kimball, who's clinical supervisor for Retreat, for all her help she always gives the program. Thank you, Amanda. And particularly for bringing Mark Oleski with you today so that we can talk about this fascinating aspect of the role psychology plays in helping people, manage their recovery. And most importantly now for the final section, to avoid relapse. So we thank Mark Oleski for joining us. Mark, how do you address the issue of relapse with people when they come in and they talk to you? Do you get the well, everybody relapses, or what do you tell them about relapse?
I think one of the things that I talk about is relapse is part of the deal, but it's not essential. Okay, and I let them know that there's very few things in life, if anything, that we actually have to be 100% at. And this is one of those things. And that's extremely difficult. Now, I let them know that that's not permission to go ahead out and say, well, Mark says I don't have to be 100%. But that this is a process. However, let's try and let's nail it. Let's nail it now.
You made a point before we went on the air about the very often people go, look, it's a disease, like other diseases, and now people are starting to understand that. They compare it very often to something chronic like diabetes. Mm-hmm. And you said something great about people sort of who are diabetic sort of relapse in dealing with that disease as well, right?
Chronic illnesses are illnesses that need to be managed. And we know with chronic illnesses, whether it's diabetes, blood pressure, addiction, whatever, okay, that people are generally non-compliant. People cheat. Okay, I know people who are diabetic who fool around with their insulin and do it deliberately so that they can eat the donut or the two donuts or, whatever with blood pressure medicine as well. So we know people are generally non-compliant with long-term things.
And we must get our heads around the notion that a relapse is not some failure of will or much, a character flaw. It's a stumble, on the road.
You're looking a lot at a lot of times as people tend to do really well, and that's foreign to them. It feels good, but I don't have a lot of experience with that. So, whether it's deliberate, conscious, unconscious, I'll relapse. I'll go back to what I know because it's safe, it's comfortable, even though it's painful and difficult. And that's the interesting thing about it.
Mm. We know there are many, many reasons people relapse, certainly avoiding triggers. We know about people, places, and things. From a psychologist standpoint, what do you tell someone about how important it is to be, aware of that stuff and guarding against it?
I think that stuff is huge, but I think what's even more important is how people identify themselves. Okay. A lot of times I see people who've been through this process multiple times and they actually stigmatize themselves. I can't. I won't. They limit their ability to get better. I don't deserve to get better. Those kinds of things are actually, I think, even more significant and more sustaining for the long term. Anybody can recognize a trigger and make a left when they normally would have made a right. But the idea, what's going on with me, about me, okay, is key to whether or not I actually implement those processes.
Just because it's a trigger doesn't mean it has to trigger any behavior.
Exactly. Exactly.
So it's true, if you change the way you think, you can change the way you behave.
And sometimes, and AA is very wise, and some of the cliches I think are just amazing. Sometimes you have to fake it before you make it. Sometimes you have to fake the behavior Just do the behavior, and then eventually you gain a sense of self-esteem from it. You may not believe it at first, but if I just do something differently than I've always done, I'm going to get a better result, I guarantee it, than what I normally would have gotten.
Yeah. All those cliches are cliches because they're true. That's how they become cliches.
They work, sure.
That's how they become cliches. And I guess it's worth – it's certainly worth mentioning right now that the actual event of a relapse has changed in the past couple of years from a stumble or a fallback – to bad behavior, to a life-threatening condition now. Commander, you can answer this as well. Mm-hmm. Are people coming in to places like retreat, and do they understand that relapse could mean death if you are using opiates? That's the real danger, right?
Sure. I mean, I think the biggest problem is this. Obviously, if you're using heroin, you have a much higher chance of overdosing and dying than if you're drinking.
Right.
However, in that moment in their addiction, when we were talking about the hole in your soul, as I like to call it, people don't necessarily care. They're ambivalent, like Mark said. I think the most important thing to realize, our surrounding relapse is that we can have lapses and we can have relapses. Mark and I talked a little bit about this yesterday. You can relapse and you can go into a full-blown relapse because a lot of it is mental as well, or you can lapse, use one time, drink one time, and get right back on the horse and keep doing what you're doing. Fake it till you make it. Yeah, you screwed up, but you can continue moving forward. This doesn't mean you have to go back to treatment immediately or go on a full-blown relapse and use every day until you get to that point. You can absolutely fake it till you make it.
Like get refocused, go from there.
Well, I tell people who don't understand it because it hasn't happened in their lives, Steve, these people always relapse. They relapse. I said, yeah, a lot of people do. A lot of people relapse a lot. Mm-hmm. But they keep coming back. Has it never occurred to you that this keep coming back? There's something there's something strong about that. Mark Oleski, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Don't be a stranger. We'd love to have you back. Amanda, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your time on this Saturday. And enjoy tomorrow. And I will see you at the parade whenever they have it. Go Birds. Take care. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.